I'm very, very surprised that even after his Calvin Klein campaign, Carlos Alcaraz did not make the list.
Yeah, that was raunchy, to say the least.
Yeah, that was as sexy, if anything.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Hold On To Your Racket, the podcast for Gen Z tennis fans. We're your hosts, Josefina
and Shravia.
Shravia and I are so excited to be creating this podcast and sharing our love for tennis with you all.
Josefina and I are two college gals and tennis fanatics, united together by our on-the-court and off-the-court companionship.
And we're the female Gen Z voices in modern-day tennis you've been looking for, so we hope you enjoy this episode and stay tuned for more.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Hold On To Your Racket. So, of course, we're going to get started with hot headlines. We haven't done this in a minute, but before we get started, we have our own personal anecdote to add to today's episode.
Yes, so obviously, like, Josefina and I came out with the WTA Finals episode last week, and, you know, this year we've been super busy and haven't really been able to do as regular episodes as we used to, which is totally fine by us. But a lot of my newer friends were like super excited to learn that, you know, I had a podcast and whatnot, alongside Josefina, of course. And I was telling them yesterday that, like, I have to record an episode today. And one of my friends, Eliana, was like, you know, I really want to get into tennis. Like, it's so glamorous. I feel like I really want to be like a big tennis fan when I'm older. And I'm like, why don't you just start now? And she was like, okay, wait, yeah, like, let's start now. Because she's planning on staying in around the East Coast area over the summer. And I said that she should come to the U.S. Open.
That's a must.
Yeah, so that kind of lent the question, like, so that I can give best advice to her. Because honestly, this kind of stumped me. Because Josefina and I always grew up around tennis. And we've talked a lot about how tennis, and I think now it's changing, it doesn't do the best at branding itself to younger fans. But we kind of want to brainstorm some ideas to kind of help her get into it. I told her to start following the Australian Open Instagram because that's going to be in January. But I honestly think just like following Morgan Riddle on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube is a really good way to segue into it.
Yeah, because exactly like you said, I feel like you and I, we've grown up around tennis. I can't remember a time when I did not know tennis, you know? Mm-hmm. But when we did start the podcast, I did start getting into kind of more the specifics, I guess, of the tournament system and the way that the tour works. So there were things that I didn't know before we started the podcast, but I kind of always knew the scoring system, which is probably the most difficult thing to learn because it's a little bit complicated. But, I would say use outlets that can be accessible to anybody. Like, for example, right now, a really good one is the Breakpoint series on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
If you start with watching that, they explain the scoring system and different kind of aspects of tennis as they go. Plus, it has interesting profiles of the top players on tour. So I think that would be a great place to start. And then from there, you could download the Tennis Live app and always know what is going on at all times. Yeah. I think that's also a good thing to have. Well, once you start understanding things.
Yeah, I think the main appeal, at least that I've noticed from a lot of like younger fans, is sort of the aesthetic of tennis as well. Mm-hmm. Like kind of like the way she said to me that it looks so glamorous. Like I think if you want to, like I think in that sense, like the scoring can come later, but like if you want to get like a sense of like what the vibes are like and all that stuff, like yeah, the Netflix show, Morgan Riddle again, these players on Instagram, like you get a vibe for what the sport is and really how international and individual it is. I think that's kind of the main difference from like American sports, which is kind of hard to wrap your head around if you're not tapped into it already.
Yeah, like for example, before before she retired, Annette Contaveit's Instagram versus like Camila Osorio's. And they both have, like, such aesthetic and beautiful Instagrams. But they're so different because they're from, one is from Estonia and the other one is from Colombia. So it's still, like different things you could look at. And it's all very nice to look at. So tennis is a great sport to get into if you like pretty things.
That's a very, yes, that's very sage advice. I think now we're going to move into some of our hot headlines on the ATP side. There's been kind of a lot that's been happening on all spheres. But of course, the news that we want to highlight first is there are some major updates in Alexander Zverev's domestic abuse history. We have been reporting on this. Well, really, it's been other more dedicated and more tapped in sports journalists who have been reporting on it. But we've been talking about it since, of course, the Olya Sharapova allegations a couple years ago. But now we have seen that other of his ex-girlfriends have also come forward with stories of domestic violence. And a German court actually just issued a penalty order a couple of weeks ago to Zverev for abuse and bodily harm against his ex-girlfriend Brenda Patea, which is obviously a familiar name. They had a child together. And the fines from this penalty order are 450,000 euros, which is about $475,000. And, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, not only just because of what the order is for, but also kind of in technicality what a penalty order means in Germany.
Mm-hmm. So officially, Zverev has been accused of physically abusing his ex-girlfriend and causing damage to her health during an argument in May 2020 in Berlin. So we can already see how drawn out this has been, like the legal process. So what exactly, as Travio was saying, does a penalty order mean, especially in this context in the German court? So from an article by Tumani Karyol in The Guardian, the quote is, "In German law, a penalty order is utilized by a public prosecutor's office when it does not consider a trial to be necessary, such as when the case is relatively simple and there is compelling evidence in favor of the accusation. The defendant has a right to contest the penalty order leading to a public trial." So Zverev did contest the order, so we will see him, like, and his legal team defend his case later in trial. But essentially, as you can see by the definition of what a penalty order is in German court, there was sufficient evidence to accuse Zverev of physically abusing his ex-girlfriend. And the fact that he contested it has nothing to do with whether he's guilty or innocent. It just means that he wants to deny the accusations for as long as possible and draw this out for as long as possible. And hopefully that strategy does not work.
Yeah, I think it's especially concerning. We, like, the ATP obviously did whatever investigation or so they called it to, you know, be like, oh, we don't really think there's anything, you know, worthy here to kick him out back when the Sharapova allegations came out. This is not Maria Sharapova. This is Olya Sharapova for clarification. But in response to this penalty order, back in July, when the German court first applied for the order to be issued, Zverev said, quote, "From my side, I completely reject the allegations. My lawyers are taking care of the matter. I won't say anything more about it." So it's always been this behavior of, like, him taking a step back, being like, "I completely reject everything. I don't want to talk any more about it." And, you know, we're, this episode is about the ATP Finals in Turin, and Zverev is playing there. And, you know, we're going to see him at this big stage where he's, you know, one of the top eight players in the world this year, in his comeback season, and is still facing all of these mounting accusations and legal challenges,
which, and they're really tangible now.
Yeah, which the really makes you think, when, if at all, is the ATP going to actually do something about this?
Exactly. That's been the big question since we first heard the accusations. Like you said, Olya's article with Ben Rothenberg, for example, was a big catalyst of kind of us getting more into what the ATP should be doing when it comes to their players being accused of domestic violence, assault, anything in that matter. And Alexander Zverev has been a perfect example of inaction by the ATP because he is playing at the top tournament in the world where he will become more and more famous, get more brand deals, etc. And he's just not being held accountable, even though he has literally been fined. Like, there's a tangible fine and accusation, and there is a punishment for his actions in a legal court, and the ATP has done nothing about it.
Mm-hmm. So we will continue to follow that story, and as you know, both of us were just saying, a special key eye on what the ATP will do to step in about this. But moving into some more lighthearted news on the ATP side, on November 8th, perhaps one of the most important sports article of the year was posted, which is People Magazine's Sexiest Men Alive in Sports. And we want to highlight this because three of our ATP besties got notable mentions. This is super exciting, great for the sport, great for the program. And these three are, well, actually, I'm going to let Josefina do the honors of telling us who was mentioned.
Yeah, so ninth on the list, already too low, in my opinion, Grigor Dimitrov. It's 2023, and this man is still the sexiest man in tennis. I remember all of the, there's like ATP interviews that they do just for little quips for media, and every time they ask, like, who's the most attractive player on the tour, every single ATP player responds with the same person, and they say Grigor, so I think that's a fair, I think it's a fair placement on the list. And then 10th we have, well, no, Shravia should take this one away.
Oh, yes. So in 10th place, we have Matteo Berrettini, our Italian king. My friend Eliana, who was, you know, asking how to get into tennis, I should tell her to, you know, follow Berrettini because she's Italian and loves all things Italy. So she will be very happy to see this. No need for an explanation here. I am still heartbroken over the fact that he and Isla are no longer together. And he's had a
pretty... Are you, though?
I am. Well, I'm happily taken. So my Berrettini fandom has waned a bit in that regard. But he's also had a struggled season. But I'm glad that this kind of maybe will put him back in the spotlight. Clearly, despite not having gone nearly as deep in tournaments as he usually does, still went deep enough for People Magazine to recognize him. And then in 11th spot right after, we have an American in the mix, Francis Tiafoe, getting the recognition that he deserves.
Yeah. Well, I will say, though, that the magazine's listing was and, like, order was a little bit questionable, considering all three deserve to be placed higher than Travis Kelce and his brother, who were placed first and second. And I honestly would not know who they are if it were not for his girlfriend. And that is very, what's it called, stereotypical of me, but I don't care. Because I know every single ATP player, and they don't. So it doesn't even matter. But I will say, though, I'm very, very surprised that even after his Calvin Klein campaign, Carlos Alcaraz did not make the list.
Yeah, that was raunchy, to say the least.
Yeah, that was as sexy, if anything.
Yeah, that was I remember being shocked when I saw that. Maybe, you know, maybe he's kind of salty about that. Maybe that'll give him some extra fire in these Turin ATP finals. Fun fact, both of our names are in People Magazine under Morgan Riddle's article. So if you search up the article about Morgan Riddle, we are mentioned at the interview that we did.
Go read it. Go read it.
Still one of my favorite episodes that we've done. So we're basically in the same magazine as Matteo, Francis, and Grigor. So that is, you know, make of that what you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our names are basically next to theirs. So however you want to interpret that, you go ahead and do that. But next we have kind of sad news, but also sad news about a player that we love. Not that sad. It's just a natural, it's the natural flow of events when it comes to the world of tennis. John Millman has announced his retirement on November 9th on Instagram. He said, "After this year's Australian summer, I'll be retiring from professional tennis. I had a dream. as a kid to play the game I love and to be able to do it for so long has been a great privilege. I hope I gave you all something to cheer for.
Yeah, I mean, Milman has been a staple of the tour for quite some time now. He always draws in a lot of fans as well, and I think it's great to... the Australians always have a really strong affinity to the Melbourne tournament, but I think it'll be nice for him to round out his career there. He reached world number 33 as his highest ranking. Obviously, a lot of us remember his 2018 US Open victory over Roger Federer in 5 sets. I was heartbroken, but it was a big moment, and people kind of just generally love the guy for his attitude, his mental toughness. He also has been through the trials and tribulations of injuries that we've seen kind of really take a toll on tennis players, especially just considering all the travel, the length of the season. This is something that Josefina and I have talked about in the past, actually, where a lot of players kind of, even recently, are really pointing out concerns about the length of the season. And interestingly, the ATP Tour uses different types of balls, like tennis balls, at every tournament. And different tennis balls play differently. It has a different impact on your body, and it changes the pace of play. And people were observing kind of qualitatively on the tour, a lot of players were getting wrist injuries or arm injuries, and complaining about how the ATP is switching up its balls too quickly. Also about scheduling, like there were some matches in Paris that started way too late. So the reason I'm just mentioning this is because Milman said in an interview that he still feels as if he can play top 100 level tennis, but his injuries have been plaguing his career, especially recently. And this is a concern that other players have brought up as well in the ATP. So I wonder if, you know, we really do need to see some changes in terms of scheduling, the tennis balls, just all this stuff, because tennis is extremely demanding when you put the travel and individual nature on it as well.
Yeah. As you were saying, I think I remember very recently during the Paris Masters, Yannick Sinner had to retire because his match ended too late, and his next match was scheduled for basically a few hours after it, and he did not have time to recover, which is absolutely ridiculous, because that should just not be a reason for one of the top players that was doing really well in the tournament to drop out completely. It's just crazy to me. But back to John Millman, he is and has been one of our favorites, Hodder's favorites. And as Alex Demenor commented on John Millman's post, he said, "We love you, Johnny, we do. Oh, Johnny, we love you. Oi, oi." That's like an Australian cheer, mm-hmm. And I loved it.
All right, so, and now we get to talk about the tennis, the actual tennis that is being played. The tennis that was played last week, though, was WTA Finals. Check out our episode about that if you haven't already. But we wanted to congratulate Iga Swiatek for winning that trophy without dropping a set. So really in true Iga fashion. And she also reclaimed the world number one ranking, which we know was on the line at that tournament, and, you know, the battle between her and Sabalenka. But Iga, I mean, she hit it out of the park. She defeated Jessica Pegula 6-1, 6-love in the final. So I think Pegula said, like, afterwards, something like, "I fell victim to the Iga bakery, but, you know, it's okay. I'm proud of my performance." But, you know, Iga really, she had a goal in mind at this tournament, and she definitely accomplished it.
Yeah, I'm really happy to see her back at the top spot, and also really happy to have seen Pegula in the final here. But now that we've covered that quickly, we're going to move into the ATP Finals in Turin, which are happening this week. Basically, as we speak, 2 matches have already taken place. But this year's field includes Novak Djokovic, of course, the world number one, Carlos Alcaraz, Daniil Medvedev, Yannick Sinner, Andre Rublev, Stefanos Tsitsipas, Alexander Zverev, and Holger Rune. Interesting. But like the WTA Finals, we have 2 groups again. Here, the names are more boring. Red group and green group. And it works the same. Round-robin format in each group with 4 players.
And then the two finalists go to the main semifinals and play the other placing. So for example, the first standing in the green group plays the second standing in the red group, mm-hmm. and vice versa.
Yeah. And then, of course, semis to finals. And then we have the champion at the year's end. And we're going to start by... Oh, these are taking place in Turin, Italy, which they were there last year as well. But let's start with the green group. And obviously, we have Novak Djokovic, the world number one here. He has played the least amount of tournaments this year out of all the Turin contestants, yet, of course, has come out on top. And we say, of course, because... it's Novak Djokovic. There is history on the line once again for him. 2 years ago, Novak beat Pete Sampras's record for the most year-end world number one finishes, breaking his record of 6, and this year could mark his 8th. The way for Alcaraz to get world number one is, you know, it's very unlikely, so we are really seeing kind of a guaranteed Novak year-end number one finish. And this would also mean that he would become the only player in the ATP rankings history to reach 400 weeks at the top spot. Roger Federer is the only other player to have even surpassed the 300 weeks mark. So honestly, history is on the line for Novak, but it's really just him chasing his own history.
Yeah, that's how it goes with Novak. It's like, even... the hero that lived long enough to become the villain. Or maybe he was the villain the whole time. Anyways, that's just my personal opinion. But he could also grab his 7th ATP Finals title and therefore surpass Roger Federer's record. But maybe it was because we were kind of tapped out this year with, you know, the lessening of hotter content. But we just feel like Djokovic was barely even there this season. Like, he went so under the radar. The only match of his that we remember was his Wimbledon final to Alcaraz, which was a loss, of course, and therefore signifies that he's not in top form, but he was. And he excelled through and through throughout his season. And since that loss in Wimbledon, Novak has been undefeated, so he certainly came back with a vengeance, as he tends to do, and he fed off of that loss very, very successfully.
Yeah, like, I think it's just because people always take Novak for granted, so, like, when people are talking about a lot of other players, like, it doesn't mean that he's not having the best season out of all of them. It just means that it's not news, which is funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's certainly how I felt. But Novak is the defending champion here. He has had a 51-5 record this year and won the Australian Open, Roland Garros, and the US Open, as well as Cincinnati, which is, of course, a Masters 1000 title, Paris, which is also a Masters, and then Adelaide at the beginning of the year. And that Paris tournament is an indoor tournament and, you know, just finished like a couple weeks ago. So he is really riding that steam. And as Josefina said, since that Wimbledon loss to Alcaraz in the finals, this man has been undefeated. 36 years old and not letting up. I mean, the rest of the field really does look like a bunch of babies in comparison. And we're honestly excited to see whether these newer players can take him on, because I think that's always a question. I don't know if we're there yet, but I mean, within this group at least, I feel like it's hard to see anyone else coming out as the victor. And I'm just trying to check and see how his match against Holger Rune today went. It's actually ongoing right now. And he, you know, they're locked 1 set all. And they were both tiebreaks, so.
Wow. So it sounds like a close match. But as you said, I really hope that the rest of the field isn't just fighting for the second spot. I hope that someone could actually contest Novak in this tournament. But we have yet to see whether that's possible. But Rune is doing pretty well. But of course, you can't count that as anything because, I don't know, Djokovic always finds a way somehow. The next player in this field is a younger player, one of our favorite Gen Zs, Jannik Sinner. The Italian has continued to have a solid season and just wrapped up a clean straight sets win versus Tsitsipas today. That was one of the matches that took place already. And Sinner has a losing record against all of the players in this group, so that was definitely and hopefully a confidence boost because he's proven that he can overcome whatever that past record was when it comes to actually playing in the tournament, which is very good. And he's had four titles this year, the Toronto Masters, Beijing, Vienna, both very recent titles, and 500-level tournaments, and Montpellier. And he tied with 2021 for this season where he's won the most titles. So he won four titles in 2021 as well. So he's doing very well, and he's proven to be a very consistent player. And he's also gone under the radar, but not in the way that Novak has, in the way that we're taking him for granted. But really just the fact that he's been so consistent and has actually been very successful this year, I feel like it hasn't been talked about a lot because he hasn't been, I guess, shining. He's been pretty stagnant, but in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the Grand Slams, Wimbledon semis, Australian Open and US Open round of 16, and respectively in each of those, lost to Djokovic, lost to Tsitsipas, lost to Zverev, all potential competitors here in Turin, which is what kind of, I think, a lot of people are wondering, because he does have a losing record against these guys, or has, you know, lost to them this year. So I think it's a good sign that he got that Tsitsipas win, especially after Tsitsipas is coming off of a pretty good past couple of weeks playing on the indoor courts. And I mean, Jannik Sinner's rise has been steady and really well deserved. So it's kind of, it brings the question of like, what is the next step for this crop of players like Sinner and Rune, who are a little bit under Alcaraz, to really make their mark beyond just qualifying here? And I think, like, obviously a title here would be insane, but I think we need to see them start making those Grand Slam finals like Alcaraz, Djokovic, and Medvedev have been doing. I think the next person to make a crack into that, obviously winning a Grand Slam at the ATP level right now is really difficult unless your name isn't Medvedev, Alcaraz, or Djokovic. But I really do think these guys, if one of them can do that, that could really, and do that consistently, like make a couple of those next year, we could be seeing another shift in the ATP playing field.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like we've, there's been some kind of, I guess, talk about a rivalry between Sinner and Alcaraz for a while now, but Alcaraz has just come out on top. Like, that's just undoubtedly true. But I feel like, even before we started hearing Carlos's name everywhere, we were hearing about Jannik Sinner. I think he really did break out onto the field in a consistent way before Alcaraz, yep. But Alcaraz's rise has been explosive, right?
Yes, for sure. Which I think it's kind of representative of their personalities almost. Like, Sinner is very much low-key, reserved guy. But the talent is there. He's shown he's ready. And I think his mentality is great, too. And that kind of leads us into our next point, which is he was actually quoted in an Italian newspaper recently, Corriere della Sera, which is the name of the newspaper. And he said, quote, "The pressure of tennis, it's nothing compared to a surgeon or a head of the family who has to bring dinner. The real pressure is not knowing if a missile will explode at your home in 5 hours or 5 days. Playing tennis is something that honors us." We kind of just wanted to share that because we felt it was super timely to a lot of the things going on in the world right now. But also, it gives us a window into Sinner's mindset, and more large, like at a greater level, just putting into context sport and its place in society is, you know, what these guys are doing on the court is, yes, often a great distraction, gives us so much joy, but also is in many ways, you know, that pressure that we talk about these players facing. I think this was a really refreshing sense of self-awareness from a tennis player, particularly on the ATP side.
Yeah, he's always been super mature and just bringing into context his own career versus the events of the world right now. I don't know, it's very humble of him and just very mature, and he brings that maturity on court as well. And he currently has a career high ranking of world number 4. So I almost said world number 4 in the world, but either way, yeah, so this mindset has definitely worked for him, and I think that's great. And like you said, I think it's really interesting what you said about the fact that Alcaraz's kind of rise to success and Sinner's are very reflected of their own personalities. So that is definitely something to keep in mind.
For sure. So our next player in the green group is Stefanos Tsitsipas. And I don't think we've discussed this on the podcast yet, but this is also Paula Badosa's boyfriend, which was the development.
I don't think that's real.
Yeah. But, I mean, they could, like, at least what I've been seeing on Twitter, like, they are, like, in love with each other. Like, Tsitsipas, like, has, I can't remember, like, exact quotes and stuff, but they've been very positive about their relationship. They've also both mentioned that it definitely helps that they're both tennis players and on a similar schedule. And, I mean, Paula has been largely sidelined with injury this season, so she's actually been a pretty frequent face in his box and at his tournament supporting him, which has been nice to see. She actually helped coach him and his brother in doubles, and they won their first title together recently, so that was also a sweet story, I thought.
Yeah, and Stefanos has won the ATP finals in 2019, and he actually said earlier this week that the ATP finals are bigger than a Grand Slam. That's a very Stefanos thing of him to say, considering he has won the tournament. But anyways, Tsitsipas won only one tournament this whole season, Los Cabos, and he played 24 of them. So the record is kind of iffy. But what got him here? He made the Australian Open final, which of course is huge. And then he made the French Open quarterfinals and the Wimbledon round of 16. So overall, pretty consistent Grand Slam season, I'd say, because he's made the second week of all three of the ones that he played. And then he made some good runs at bigger tournaments such as Barcelona and Rome. And then in his past three tournaments during the indoor swing. So he's just been there consistently. And sometimes that's all you need to get you to the finals. And he also has a losing record against Djokovic and Rune, and already lost his match to Sinner, who he was previously at a 5-2 record against. So his success here is going to be waning, I think. Mm-hmm. But we'll see what he pulls out of the toolbox. I don't think he has many great chances, but no. Still, especially with Sinner and Djokovic being in his group, they're both playing so well, and I'm excited to see how Jannik Sinner does. So Stefanos Tsitsipas is kind of, he's just not the main character here. As much as he would like to think he is, he's not.
Yeah, and I mean, his US Open tournament was pretty poor. Like, I think he only made it to the second round. So he's had a season where in those blocks of times he's had success, and throughout most of the Grand Slams he's done enough, but I don't think it's enough momentum to carry him to a good tournament here. Someone who is, you know, a fresh face is Holger Rune. He was actually interned last year as the alternate, and what's most striking to me, despite the fact that he's the lowest ranked player, he actually also might be the youngest, but the lowest ranked player in this field, is that he is 2-2 versus Djokovic. And Rune actually beat him in the Indoor Paris Masters in last year's final, and against him this year at the Rome quarters, but lost to Djokovic in a tight three-setter at Paris just a couple weeks ago. And the match that's going on right now is, again, super tight. So I'm just really interested in seeing, moving forward, this Rune-Djokovic rivalry, because it's so fascinating to me that Rune seems to give him trouble.
Yeah. So even this year at the Slams, Arun has been, he's had a pretty solid season. He made the round of 16 at the Australian Open, and he has had solid clay season with good performances in Rome and then making the French Open quarters. And then he also made the Wimbledon quarters. And then after that, his season kind of had like a steady decline, but then he picked it up again during the recent indoor tournaments. And I think that'll be important because he has a very like flaky mindset. He's very explosive and energetic. He's one of those young players that has a temper. He has an attitude. And I think the fact that he's been doing well in the indoor tournaments kind of has helped him, or will help him adjust to the Paris climate. And I think that'll be very good for him. But the ongoing question here with Rune has been, does he have the maturity now to continue his success and chip away at the top players in this tournament and then later on, especially? Because so far he's shown that he can be successful, but he really has to like be in the right mindset to be so. Because if he starts getting negative, just things go downhill and he just crashes and burns. But I mean, if he does find the maturity to be consistent, he can definitely contest with the top players. And I guess that's the reason he's here in the first place. But he has to prove that he really belongs here and that he's here to stay.
All right. So let's move into the red group now, where we have Carlos Alcaraz in the top seat in this group. But surprisingly enough, this is his ATP Finals debut. He actually did qualify last year, but couldn't participate due to an abdominal tear at the Paris Masters. This brings me back to one of our episodes a while ago called Abominable Abdominals. We were seeing so many abdominal injuries on the ATP side. Actually, Taylor Fritz, who was trying to qualify for the ATP Finals this season, also suffered from an abdominal injury towards the tail end of the season, which kind of brought him out of contention. But anyways, last year, Alcaraz's year-end ranking was number one, and the year before that, it was in the 30s. So he has had this meteoric rise, electric rise, and you know, playing style, personality, and debut, and past few years on the tour that obviously has been bringing in so many new fans. And I'm excited to see whether he can kind of really pose a formidable challenge to Djokovic this tournament.
Yeah, because for sure, the fight for the number one ranking spot in the past few months or even a year has come down to Alcaraz and Djokovic. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, Djokovic won this year. Alcaraz won last year. But Alcaraz did come out on top during the grass season, taking away the Wimbledon title from Djokovic, which was incredibly impressive. And I think that was pretty monumental. And he beat Djokovic in the final. Yeah, he won his second Grand Slam. That was Alcaraz's second Grand Slam, which, of course, is very important because he won the U.S. Open previously. And then he proved that he is here to win multiple Grand Slam titles, which I think is a very important distinction. He's not a one-hit wonder. But other than that, he's had six titles this year. Buenos Aires, the Indian Wells 1000, Barcelona, the Madrid 1000 tournament, and then Queen's Club and Wimbledon were consecutive wins, and then the U.S. Open semifinals, and he lost in the semifinals of the French Open to Novak, and I think it's been a very interesting rivalry kind of growing between the two of them.
Yeah, and in terms of the indoor hardcourt season so far, that's been pretty fruitless for Alcaraz. A semifinal loss to Yannick in Beijing, lost to Grigor in Shanghai pretty early, and Ross lost in the first round of the Paris Masters. So this is Alcaraz, so let's see what happens. Hasn't won a tournament since Wimbledon, but I do wonder if, you know, this event and the stage of it will really kind of propel him to a high level of tennis that we, you know and expect of him.
And then our next player in this group is Daniil Medvedev, the world number three. He's had five titles this year. Also, I feel very under the radar. He's just been there consistently doing very well. I kind of forgot. I didn't forget he existed, but I didn't realize that he had been doing so well. He's still the world number three. It's just, well, we'll talk about it in a bit. But he's won 5 titles this year, Rotterdam, Doha, Dubai, and all 3 of these tournaments were consecutive wins, by the way. So that's about 15 matches in a row that he won, maybe more, maybe a little bit less. And then he made the Indian Wells Finals and then won Miami. So nearly a sunshine double.
Mm-hmm.
So just very successful even in the beginning of the year. And then he won Rome, the Rome Masters. And then he lost in the Vienna and Beijing finals to Yannick in both tournaments, which I think is very interesting and proves that Yannick really has kind of secured his top spot here. And then he lost in the first round of Paris to sexy man Grigor, who actually made the final. I forgot about that. But Grigor Dimitrov made the Paris finals this year and lost against Djokovic. So I think that's something that should be noted, maybe added to his sexiness.
And I mean, I think Medvedev, like, winning Rome is huge, like a clay court kind of assurance that maybe he doesn't hate that so much. He had a pretty slow start at the slams this year. 3rd round loss at Australian Open to Sebastian Korda, 1st round loss at Roland Garros, but then Wimbledon semis, lost to Alcaraz, and then US Open final, losing to Novak. So he did seem to pick it up at the Grand Slam level later on, and he's been sitting pretty comfortably at the number 3 spot, but I think we both want to see him back in the mix of fighting for number 1. That was kind of the case last year and a little bit of the year before, but we want to see kind of more of a contest between Novak, Carlos, Medvedev, anyone else who's able to bring it, but these are the 3 players who right now seem like a safer slam potential, and it could be interesting to see them battle it out for that spot as well. But Medvedev has complained about the speed of the turn court in the past, has lost all 3 of his round-robin matches last year, so let's see how he deals with the condition this time around. And if he's able to get an ATP Finals title, because I think he already has one, but not one in Turin.
I would love to see him do well in this tournament, honestly. It could be like a really good catalyst for next year. And like we said, just becoming a viable rival to Novak and Carlos, just straight off the bat from the beginning of the year. But our next player is Andrei Rublev, who is the world number 5 and at a current career high ranking. And he has won 2 titles this year, the Bastad 250, and also his first Masters title in Monte Carlo. He came back from a love 30, 1-4, kind of, what's it called? The opposite deficit of a head start. Yeah, deficit in the 3rd set versus Rune. So very solid mindset going into that, and his interview afterwards was, I don't know, just speaking about how humble he was to win it and that he was just there to play tennis, that he just wanted to try his best in case he got a chance, and then he ended up taking that chance and winning the entire tournament. So again, another very, he can be explosive at times, he does have an attitude, but he's very mature and humble, especially off court. His personality is just very friendly and amazing, as we've seen from like ATP media and all that, all the stuff that, all the content we love, I don't know, inhaling. What's the other word for inhaling? Digesting. Yeah.
In terms of Grand Slams, he made the quarters of Australian Open, Wimbledon, and the US Open, but lost to Novak twice and then Daniil at the US Open. So these are not embarrassing losses, but people he would have to beat here. He has had good success in the indoor season so far, Shanghai finals, Paris semis, losing to Novak in 3 tight sets, and made the semis here at Turin just last year. So interesting to see if he can take it one step further. Rublev and Alcaraz have actually never showed off before, so if we can see that matchup, I think that'll be really exciting. So he's been really consistent, especially recently been doing really well. So I just wonder, again, as always with Rublev, when it comes to playing these big players, does he have enough oomph to do it not just once, but he's going to need to do it several times because this whole tournament is just them playing each other.
Was Rublev the one that had that semifinal curse? Was that Rublev?
I think that was Maria Sakkari.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That was from the Breakpoint show. But, Rublev was the 500 king.
Yes.
So, still amazing to see that he won his first Masters title. I'm really excited to see what that means for him next year. And, of course, in this tournament on, like, a shorter amount of time. But next up, we have Alexander Zverev. He is currently the world number 8 and coming back from his 2022 ankle sprain at the French Open. So he is back in the top 10. He has won 2 titles this year, the Hamburg 500. He's made the US Open quarterfinals and then Chengdu, which is a 250 tournament. And he won the ATP finals in 2021, but has lost his most recent match to every single player in this group. But again, going back to what we were talking about during hot headlines, there's just been some sort of, even something that I feel right now, reporting on Zverev's upcoming Turin, I guess, tournament. There's just this trickle-down effect of inaction by the ATP causing us to have to continue reporting on him and talking about his tennis. And I feel that that adds legitimacy to his place on tour, which is insane, and it's just sad.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I totally agree with you in that point of, like, the fact that we have to continue talking about him as a player and as a top player, like, on this tour. Why are we even at that stage? Like, why are we still talking about this man as a tennis player and giving him that stage and that platform and legitimacy when there are literal court orders against him for domestic violence? So It's really troubling to see.
Thank you so much for joining us, and that is Game, Set, and Match for today.
If you like this episode, please let us know and stay tuned for more. We'll be providing you all the coverage of upcoming tennis and, of course, all the tea on tour.
Email us at holdontoyourracket@gmail.com for any questions and leave a rating on whatever platform you're listening on.
Hold On To Your Racket is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts.
Follow us on social media at Hold On To Your Racket on Instagram and at HOTYR_tennispod on Twitter.
And remember, my name is Josefina.
And my name is Shravya.
And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to hold on to your racket until next time.